Evening, ladies and gentlemen. Well, and Excellency, friends, overwhelming basically it's friends, good evening and welcome to everyone. Well, in more than one sense, this evening is about worlds that are no more. Our two distinguished speakers, Tito Mesut Benadi and Aline Pnina Tayar, will in fact recount the story of the Sephardic Jews, who in my own lifetime, in your own lifetime basically, have practically ceased to exist in the North African and Middle Eastern milieu in which they used to inhabit. Much more brutal and dramatic, on the other hand, was the demise of the Ashkenazi Jewish world that existed in Europe prior to the Second World War. Over the last few months, we have in fact seen numerous ceremonies commemorating the Shoah or the Holocaust, especially arising out of the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. I need not remind you of the millions who perished. That is a well-established fact. Despite those who seek to rewrite history and fan the flames of anti-Semitism. But we do need to remember that these aggregate figures are made up of millions of individual tragedies, whose consequences affected not only those who perished, but also those who survived them. It is to these victims, dead and alive, that this evening is dedicated. The scale of the genocide affecting Jewish people is probably unparalleled in history, but we must not forget others, such as the Armenians, who were, indeed are, set aside for special treatment. Regrettably, genocide is not a thing of the past, and it is shameful to see our governments stand idle, or certainly not do enough, to put a stop to the tragedy unfolding in places like Darfur. But this evening is not just about loss and lament, it is also about overcoming adversity, adapting, and rebuilding. Because out of the ashes there emerged Israel, a controversial and yet unique laboratory, where Jews drawn from the four corners of the world have reinvented themselves as Israelis in what is the latest and undoubtedly not the last reincarnation of the Jewish people. But I will not take up more of your time. I would, in fact, therefore like to introduce the first of our speakers for tonight, Tito Mesut Benadi, MBE, who was born in Gibraltar on the 17th July 1930. He was educated in Gibraltar and Jews College London. After a very successful career in the field of insurance, he took early retirement and turned to his real passion in life, history, the writing of it and publishing it and researching. He was made an MBE in 2000 for his work in reconstructing the early 18th century history of Gibraltar, as the early records had been lost in the Great Siege at the end of the 18th century. He lives in England, but spends considerable periods in Gibraltar. So I give you Tito Mesut Benadi.
Thank you, Carmel. Your Excellency, Mr. Moderator, ladies and gentlemen, I have been asked to give a history of the Sephardi Jews in half an hour, and I'm not going to because it is impossible. I'm just going to give you some salient facts which I think are interesting and some of which are ignored by traditional Jewish historians. So I'm going to talk about the Jews of the Mediterranean. The Jews emerged out of the mists of history as a people different from the rest of their Canaanite neighbors in the 6th century BC. Today, they are the only one of those tribes who have maintained a separate identity. But in the early days, the most successful of those tribes were the Phoenicians. They have long disappeared from history, but I will be referring to them later on. The Jews have retained their separate identity because of their religious, highly moral and strong beliefs in a single God, and they were the pioneers of monotheistic religions, which today in various reincarnations is adopted by the whole of Europe and the Middle East. The material and spiritual future of the Jewish people was assured, first of all, by the Babylonian captivity, where they formed very important centers of culture and learning, which lasted for over 1,000 years, and the beneficent rule of the Ptolemies of Egypt. Under the Ptolemies, the Jews prospered greatly, and we find them spreading through the Mediterranean lands. There were, under the Roman Empire, there was, of course, an important community established in Rome, but they were also right through the Middle East, and if you want to follow them, then all you have to do is read in the Acts of the Apostles the voyages of St. Paul in his missionary travels through the Middle East. But the largest of these communities at the time was in Egypt. The number was so large that at one time they even had a temple at Leontopolis in the Nile Delta, which had been founded by the high priest Onias when he escaped to Egypt, when he went to Egypt to escape the persecutions of Antiochus Epiphanes. After the restoration of the temple in Jerusalem, the temple of Onias continued being used, and this saved the Jews of Egypt the onerous task of having to make a pilgrimage 3 times a year to present their sacrifices at the temple in Jerusalem. And this temple was closed by the Emperor Vespasian in 73 AD, shortly after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. In 1920, the well-known writer H.G. Wells, in his Outline of History, put forward the suggestion that the numbers of the Jewish community of the great commercial center of Alexandria was a consequence of and was increased by the number of Phoenicians who adopted the Jewish religion. Well, Wells was known as to be a writer of science fiction, so nobody paid any attention. Of course, the Phoenicians were a people very similar to the Jews, and we owe our Western alphabet to them. They introduced the Proto-Semitic alphabet to Greece, and of course the Latin alphabet is descended from that. We know that from the time of the Maccabees, which I've been talking about, there were Jewish communities along the North African coast, particularly in Cyrene, which was part of the Ptolemaic Empire in Libya, and of course they got as far as Tunis. And then there is a gap, but 6 centuries later we find all of a sudden there was a large community, a Jewish community in Spain. Now each of these communities developed slightly different customs, but they all maintained the same religion. I mean, there were no schisms, religious schisms. There were differences in habits and customs and so on, but the religion was the same. The Jewish community in Spain became, in time, one of the most important communities of the Jewish world. They produced, because they were living in what was the highest civilization in Western Europe at the time, in the golden age of the Caliphs of Cordoba. They produced great philosophers like Moses Maimonides and Judah Halevi, and poets of the caliber of Solomon Ibn Gabirol of Malaga, as well as countless other scholars, and I'm not going to enumerate them all. You'll be pleased to hear. In 1492, the Jews were expelled from Spain. It wasn't so much that they were Jews, but Queen Isabella was worried about their influence on those Jews who had, through persecution, been forced to accept Christianity. And she felt that as long as there was a Jewish community, the conversos, the new Christians, would always be wanting to go back to their Jewish roots And this is something the Catholic Church was not in favor of. I don't have to tell you that. The number of Jews who left Spain, and some were allowed to convert, the number of Jews who left was about 100,000. The biggest number went to Portugal, because it was so close by, where they were hospitably received, but 5 years later, they were all forcibly converted by the Portuguese crown. They weren't given the option of leaving, they were converted. The crown didn't want to lose these rather important influx of immigrants, so they were forcibly converted. We find that in subsequent centuries, the ones who were rich and could get away formed Sephardic communities in Bordeaux, Hamburg, Amsterdam, London. But that's outside the Mediterranean and outside our field. The Jews who left Spain and didn't go to Portugal went mostly to Muslim lands. The second place that they went to, because of its proximity, was Morocco. But a number were very hospitably received by the Grand Duke of Tuscany in Livorno and by the Ottomans, and they established communities all over the Balkans, and particularly the great Jewish community of Salonika, which was destroyed in the Holocaust. These people had a very Spanish sense of their own worth, and I should think they were rather pushy, and they tended to overcome the culture of the communities that they came amongst. I mean, in Morocco, for example, we find that there was a difference between the Toshavim, the native autochthonous Jews, and the Megorashim, the exiles who arrived, and eventually the Spanish Jews won the day, and they have completely eclipsed the others. I understand from Aline's book that a similar thing happened in Tunisia when the European Jews started settling there in the later centuries. Today, we divide the Jewish world into two sections. The Ashkenazim, or Jews of Northern Europe, who derive their name from Ashkenaz, which is the Hebrew term for Germany, and the Sephardim, the Jews of Muslim and Mediterranean lands, who take their name from Sepharad, which is the Hebrew name for Spain. It is obvious that many of the communities that call themselves Sephardim have had nothing to do with Spain. You had native communities in Iraq, Iran, India, and so on. But there is a difference in culture, but not in religion, between the Jews of the Mediterranean and Middle East and the Northern Jews, which is possibly largely caused by the different living conditions. There are also certain differences in the liturgy, that the Ashkenazi Jews follow the Palestinian rite and the Sephardi Jews follow the Babylonian rite of the great Talmudic academies of Surah and Pumbedita. But I will digress for a moment to talk about the origin of the term Sephardi. We see it in the Bible. In the book of Obadiah, it is used, but there it refers to the capital, to Sardis, the capital of Lydia, which was the capital of the famous king Croesus. It was not until the 4th century that the Peshitta, a Christian translation of the Old Testament into Syriac, first translated Sepharad as Hispania. Now we know that it was the Phoenicians who gave Spain its present name, because in Phoenician, as in Hebrew, Sapan means a rabbit, and this was the land of the rabbits. They were referring to the wildlife and not to the inhabitants, by the way. It is one of those conundrums of history that we know nothing at all about the origins of the Spanish Jewish community until the 4th century, and obviously by that time they had been settled there for a considerable time and were quite an important part of the overall population. There is one funerary inscription that has been found, but apart from that, the first we know about it is at the Council of Elvira, which was close to Granada, which was held sometime between 300 and 306 AD. And this was a meeting of bishops and other churchmen to regulate the affairs of the early church in Spain. A number of the canons promulgated at the council concerned the Jews, who were not allowed to marry or consort with Christian maidens or bless the products of their field. Priests or laymen who ate with Jews were to be excommunicated, as well as all Christians who married a Jew. Well, it is obvious that the church fathers weren't inventing things. They were talking about things that they considered important, the things that were happening. So it just goes to show to what extent the Jews were by that time already integrated into Spanish society. And when you consider that Spain is as far from the Holy Land as you can get in the Mediterranean, it raises a question of how did the Spanish Jewish community originate. We know that Judaism, that the Jews radiated outwards from the Holy Land. And we think of them as being carried out by family groups who emigrated or were transported as captives. And this, of course, occurred. But I don't think that is the whole answer. After Spain became integrated into the Roman world, it is likely that small groups of Jewish merchants may have settled there with their families and maintained a correspondence and contacts with their relatives in Israel and the temple in Jerusalem. In addition, we know that a number of Jewish prisoners of war were sent as slaves to work in the mines after the destruction of the temple in AD 70 and after the Bar Kokhba revolt of AD 135. But most would have been worked to death in the mines. It was a very short life if you were a slave in a mine. But some may have survived, and some may have married local women and founded Jewish families. And there was another class of, or another type of origin of Jewish families in Spain. After the wars in Judea, the Romans enslaved not only the men, but also the women, and the more attractive were given to the legionnaires as wives. And many of them would have brought up their children as Jews. You know, in Jewish religion, the descent goes through the mother and not through the father. There is evidence of this. The old Jewish communities of Mainz and Worms in Germany claim that is how they originally began. And the historian Goetz mentions a tribe of Jews that lived at the foot of the Pyrenees and defended the passes through the mountains against the Franks. So this, to my mind, is obviously people with a military background descended from a colony of legionnaires. Another factor that was probably of even greater importance was the Phoenician culture of Spain. History does not record much about what happened to the Phoenicians of southern Spain and the Maghreb. But the Babylonian Talmud gives us some indication. The great teacher Rav of the 3rd century AD, he was a great Talmudic teacher, is quoted as saying, "From Tyre to Carthage they know Israel and their Father in heaven." In other words, many of the Phoenicians had changed over to the Jewish religion. This is confirmed by Muslim sources. Ibn Khaldun, the great 14th century Tunisian historian, in his History of the Berbers, states, "Some of the Berbers professed the Jewish religion which they had learnt from their powerful neighbours, the Israelites of Syria." And we must be referring to the Jewish Phoenicians, because that the description of Israelites of Syria would then fit. And he lists the numerous Berber tribes that converted to Judaism: the Jerawa of the Aras Mountains, the Nafusa of Tunisia, the Fendelaus, the Mediouna, the Bahloul, the Fiyata, and the Fazaz of Morocco. He also relates how the Arab invasion of North Africa was at first defeated by the powerful Jerawa tribe under their Jewish queen Kahina, and who held them back for about 10 years. And it was not until after they had defeated Kahina and killed her in battle that they were able to proceed with the conquest of North Africa. After her death, her sons and the tribe adopted Islam. The first 3 centuries of our era were a period of great spiritual ferment around the shores of the Mediterranean. People were searching for a new faith to replace the old discredited anthropomorphic gods of the Babylonian, the Egyptian, Greek, and Roman pantheons. It was this dissatisfaction, it was this search for something new, which of course led to Christianity becoming so important in these areas. But the Phoenicians, who had occupied and colonized the area of from Carthage to the Straits of Gibraltar and the south of Spain, were a Canaanite people, akin to the Hebrews linguistically, ethnically, and culturally. And many of them found Judaism more accessible than Christianity, which by then had been heavily Hellenized. In spite of the fact that Judaism was completely intransigent as to its social customs of things like kashrut and circumcision, but for the Phoenicians this wasn't difficult because it was something that they did themselves already. These days we consider that there's a line going through the Strait of Gibraltar that divides 2 different cultures, but it was not always so. This only dates from about the 12th century with the decline of Muslim Spain. Before that, Spain and North Africa was a single cultural and geographic unit going back to classical times. Although Spain is 2,000 miles from the cradle of civilization in the Middle East, we find that there were commercial relations between Egypt and Minoa and the east and south coast of southeast coast of Spain as early as 4,500 years ago. The attraction was the mineral wealth of the Iberian Peninsula. Particularly in those days, there was the gold of the Sierra Nevada. For a time, the trade was interrupted by the eruption into the Middle East of barbarian tribes, including the Dorian Greeks, which destroyed the Minoan civilization. But after several hundred years, the routes were reopened by the Phoenicians, who, although were a tribe of Canaanite origin, seems to have taken the over the maritime traditions of the Minoans. I mean, the then who were thrown out of the land. They appear in Egyptian history as the people of the sea, and in the Bible as the Philistines. Phoenician traditions claim that they reached the Pillars of Hercules in around 1000 BC, about the time that David and Solomon were kings of Israel. And they afterwards, some years later, founded the great Egyptian emporium, the trading emporium of Cadiz. They were interested at the time in the rich silver and copper mines of Tartessos, the Tarshish of the Bible, which became heavily Easternized, although by then the inhabitants were mostly, and certainly the rulers, were Celts, because the Celts had been coming in across the Pyrenees at the same time as the Phoenicians were colonizing the south. But of course the Phoenicians came in small numbers, they were traders. The Celts was a migration of tribes from Central Europe into the peninsula, and they had a much greater long-term influence. Several centuries later, the Phoenicians of Tyre founded Carthage, which built a great empire in the western Mediterranean. The assumption is sometimes made that after Carthage was captured and destroyed by Scipio Africanus in 146 BC, Phoenician culture was destroyed and all vestiges of it disappeared. But in fact, Phoenician culture and Carthaginian culture survived for centuries. In the words of Professor Salo Baron, who has written the definitive history of the Jews, it's all 18 volumes of it, he writes, "Even after the Punic Wars, Carthage was not such a deserted region as would appear from Roman literary records. Excavations make it ever clearer that a flourishing Semitic civilization persisted in North Africa for centuries after the destruction of the capital by Scipio." Spain too had come under Roman rule, and its people were substantially Romanized. But in the south, Semitic culture also persisted, because we have the old Phoenician colonies referred to as the Basilo Phoenicians, who obviously kept their old culture. And this covered the area which today is represented in the provinces of Cadiz, Malaga, and Granada, that part of the southern Andalusia. The disappearance of the political structures of the Phoenicians after the destruction of Carthage and the incorporation of their cities in the east into the Seleucid Empire, which was another of the successor states of Alexander the Great, left them without a cultural base, the base that they had always enjoyed, and they had to carve out a new place for themselves in international society. And I quote Baron again, "Most decisive seems to have been the social situation confronting these colonists after the loss of the mother cities of Tyre, Sidon, and Carthage. While tenaciously clinging to their ethnic and economic peculiarity, these Phoenician ghettos in Rome and Alexandria, in Persia and in Spain, gradually developed the characteristics of a nationality without state or territory. Hard-pressed, this race would quite naturally have adopted the patterns of belief and behavior developed by a related people through centuries of similar experiences," referring to the Hebrews. "Thus it came about that in the centuries following the annihilation of Phoenician and Carthaginian political power, these Semites, carrying with them a considerable mixture of native, in North Africa, especially Berber blood, swelled the ranks of Jewish converts with a related type of people. In short, a vanishing world factor, the Phoenician, disappeared within the new world factor, the diaspora Jew." So I think it is very likely that the large Jewish communities that we find in Andalusia in the 4th century AD and afterwards were of Phoenician origin. There were so many Jews in Granada that the Muslims called it Granada al-Yahud. They claimed that they had first settled there when they were exiled from Palestine by Nebuchadnezzar in the 6th century BC. And I think this reflects a folk memory 900 years later on of when they first arrived. But of course, I doubt whether they arrived as Hebrews in Spain. They must have arrived as Phoenicians. Very interesting is the situation of Lucena. The city of Lucena is known as the Jewish capital of Spain, or was known as the Jewish capital of Spain. We learn from a religious case referred to Babylonia, to Natronai Gaon, in the year 853 AD, that it was described as a Jewish city without any Gentiles at all. And 300 years later, the geographer Mohammed al-Idrisi says that the center of the town within the walls was inhabited entirely by Jews, and the Muslims lived in the outskirts, which was a completely different to the usual order of things. So when you find this recurring in Spain, when there was persecution, they say, well, you know, you can't blame us for what happened to Jesus in Palestine, because we have been here since the time of Nebuchadnezzar. And of course, they were not the only ones to claim that. I mean, you get the Jews of Jerba saying the same thing. And I think, they were there at that time, but they weren't there as Jews, they were there as Phoenicians, who later converted. Well, as I've said, and I'm not going to keep you any longer, the Jewish communities of the Western Mediterranean had diverse origins. What we cannot determine 2,000 years later, because we no longer have the evidence, is what proportion of these communities were made up of descendants of converts, and what proportion arrived from Palestine in the various ways I have described. The first settlements in northwest Africa, particularly on the Tunisia and Libyan side, probably date from the time when Libya was part of Ptolemaic Egypt. And I think that the later communities of the Maghreb and southern Spain were probably largely augmented by the number of Berber Phoenicians and Bastrol of Phoenicians who converted to the Jewish religion. Thank you.
Well, now after having more or less like an overview or a general history, we're going to go into the specific, which leads us, of course, to the second speaker for this evening. Born in Malta in 1948, Aline Pnina Tayar spent the first part of her childhood in a kibbutz. In 1955, her family emigrated to Australia, where she was educated and graduated from the University of Sydney in 1968 with a degree in French, Italian, English and modern history. On her return to Europe, she worked in Paris as an assistant, then spent a year in Tunisia as a translator. She has traveled widely, in fact, but specifically at that time for about 6 years, and she finally trained as a conference interpreter in Paris and Brussels, and has since 1978 worked for the institutions of the European Union, her languages being French, Italian, Spanish and Portuguese. Since 1979, her permanent home has been in the United Kingdom, first in London and for the past 19 years in Bath. Aline Tayar is a published poet, and from 1999-2000 has been Foreign Affairs Advisor in the New York Literary Journal Response. How Shall We Sing is her first book, which incidentally is available for sale outside. She's currently completing a novel set against the background of the doctor's strike in Malta in the 1970s, and is also researching a book on her Maltese-born great-uncles who became rubber barons in Peru at the beginning of the 20th century. So you can see that that's one Sephardic Jewish family which has certainly got around. Ali.
Good evening, everybody. And thank you, Tito, for giving us the background. And I'd be interested to know where the Maltese fit in. Are the Maltese descended from Phoenicians as well? That would be an interesting story to know. Anyway, so we've heard this historical picture, and I've been invited to give a personal view to present a sort of case study, a micro-history of a Mediterranean Jewish family, my own, with all its typical ramifications extending throughout the whole of the region and later on well beyond the region, those uncles, great uncles in Peru. It's a story, or rather a series of stories, recounted in my book, How Shall We Sing?, which was published by Pan Macmillan in its Picador imprint. In a mixture of genre, biography, autobiography, travelogue, and popular history, I set out to take a look at each particular Mediterranean Jewish community in which my family has lived and to tell their story within that community, moving from Malta to Florence, Cairo, Sfax, and finally a kibbutz in Israel. I start in Tunisia, where my mother was born and where part of her family had lived since the beginning of the 18th century, arriving there following the 1492 expulsions from Spain via Venice and Livorno. The other branch of her family, on the other hand, could trace their history in North Africa from well before the arrival of the Arabs, and there were plenty of blue-eyed Berbers in my mother's ancestry. As a child, my mother lived in the seaside town of La Goulette. This is a picture of La Goulette in the 1950s. The pier is no longer there and it's pretty run down these days. But that's what it looked like when my mother was a child. In La Goulette, there was a large Jewish community which sustained at least four synagogues. At one of these temples, which actually formed part of my mother's childhood home, her great-grandfather, Jacob Arus, officiated. This is Jacob Arus, who had blue eyes, bear eyes. He never wore anything other than the oriental clothes you see him wearing there, a jalabiya and a tarbush. And to me, growing up in Australia, he remains totally exotic. Even his surname can hardly be distinguished from an Arab name, Arus, which I think in Maltese also means a fiancé. I think it's the same word. On my father's side, the Tayars arrived in Malta from Tripolitania in 1846, when my great-great-grandfather, Rabbi Jacob Tayar, was invited by the growing Jewish community of the island to take up the post of part-time rabbi. This is a portrait that Shelley Tayar has in her home. Some of you might have seen it if you visited her home. It's in need of a bit of cleaning, but he looks pretty Tripolitanian to me. From Malta, over the next four generations, the family branched out to Florence, Cairo, Lyon, and Israel, as well as beyond the Mediterranean to Australia, Canada, and Peru. My South American great uncles, in fact, never lost their nostalgia for Malta, naming one of the 16 ships that they owned and which plied the Amazon, the Melita. Crisscrossing the Mediterranean from generation to generation, my ancestors moved around in search of husbands, wives, a better education, a more congenial way of life. And in this process, they built up an intricate network of personal and economic relations that covered the whole region. This is a picture of my grandmother's family. The two Peruvian brothers have already gone to Peru. A sister, Rebecca, was already married and living in Cairo. My grandmother, here. This picture was taken in 1903 in Valletta, just before her marriage, is the only one of her brothers and sisters who remained on the island. Mary married and settled in Sfax, which was her mother Julia's hometown. Jacob came from Corfu. Emilia married and settled in Paris. Elise settled in Paris too. Daniel practiced as a doctor in Rome and then finally in Tunis. And that's a very typical history of a family that moved all around the Mediterranean. And in the next generation, my father and mother. My mother was from Tunis, La Goulette, my father from Malta. This is a picture of their marriage, and so on, from one generation to the other, moving across the Mediterranean. This history of a family with branches all around the Mediterranean and beyond will also be familiar to many Maltese families who aren't Jews. After all, there were Maltese communities in Tunis, Cairo, Tangiers, Algiers, and many other places during the 19th century and the earlier part of the 20th century. However, in writing my book, I came to see that my family's hold in every place that they settled in was always a tenuous one, no matter how at home they seemed to be in the surrounding environment. The rise of nationalism and the nation states in the first half of the 20th century meant that their identity as Italians, Egyptians, Tunisians was eventually called into question. Though the Jews of the Mediterranean were mostly spared the fate of the Jews of Eastern and Central Europe, with the notable exception of the Jews of Salonika, after the Second World War, most of the Jewish communities around the Mediterranean were greatly diminished or completely disappeared. Nowhere was this more dramatically the case, at least in my own personal family history, than with my cousins who lived in Cairo. This is one of my father's cousins, Enrico Nahum. Enrico married his Maltese cousin, Ida. Unfortunately, I don't have a picture of Ida. And they lived in Cairo. They lived there very happily until the 1950s. If the definition of Egyptian included being Muslim, though, after the Second World War, with the rise of Egyptian nationalism, the Jews seemed to have no place at all in the new order. The Nahums, though, were very slow to realize that they had no place in Egypt. And once they did, they had nowhere to go because they could not go directly from Egypt to Israel. They had to go out and then go to Israel. But Enrico was born in Tripoli, and having been born in Tripoli, he had no passport, so he had no nation, no country he could look to take him in, which meant that they stayed on and on and on, and only in the only in 1967, after the 1967 war, was he able to leave when the Dutch embassy very kindly gave him a laissez-passer and allowed him to travel to Amsterdam. And from Amsterdam, he was then able to emigrate to Israel. In Italy, there's an equally dramatic story there. My father's family living in Florence had always thought of themselves as Italians. Here you find Ugo Tayar, who was my grandfather Abramino's youngest brother. He was born in Malta, but left Malta at the age of 16 to work as a shipping agent in Cairo, but eventually found his way to Florence, where he married a Florentine Jew, and this is his daughter Liliana. When the racial laws in Italy were passed in 1938, my family living there suddenly found themselves to be outsiders, just as they had always been in Italy in the days of the ghetto. Their Italian identity, which they had believed to be secure, was snatched away from them. Eventually, they had to go into hiding. And this is the place, a farmhouse in a place called Largnano in the Tuscan hills, where a very poor Italian farming family took them in and kept them hidden for one year. They lived in this part of the house, and the rest of the family lived in that part of the house. And here in Malta, where the Catholic religion was, until very recently, arguably the overriding defining component of identity, again, my family has never quite fitted because of their religion. This island was probably quite a scary place for Jews to settle in after 350 years of being banned to them by the Knights of Malta. The Spanish had also expelled the Jews from both Gozo and Malta in 1492, imposing perhaps the harshest conditions on them than anywhere else in Spanish dominions. Not only was everything they owned confiscated, but they had to pay the Spanish crown compensation for the loss of tributes caused by their forced departure. Each person was allowed to take just one suit of common clothing, a mattress, a pair of worn sheets, and a little food for the journey. The 20th century was to invent nothing new in heart-rending departures, though, like Cecil Roth, I like to think that the Christians of Malta, just as the Christians of Sicily, climbed up on their roofs and waved their Jewish neighbors goodbye. All that was left behind of the Jews and was a very large community in Gozo and Malta that had lived here are echoes in place names such as Jenin, Lud, or Bir Meru, or Halmushi. Between the 1492 expulsions and the departure of the Knights of Malta at the end of the 18th century, the only Jews allowed to set foot on the island were those who had the misfortune to be captured at sea by the Knights of Malta and brought back here to be ransomed. Entering through what is still known today as the Jews' Sally Port in Valletta, which I think you all know is down there, they were held hostage until such time as the Jewish communities of Livorno or Venice, or even as far away as Amsterdam, could collect enough money to pay for their release. Thus, Malta became unique in history as being a place where the Jewish community was made up wholly of prisoners. When my great-great-grandfather came here, there were still no more than 100 Jews living in Malta, though the ban on their residing here had been lifted once Napoleon expelled the Knights from Malta. Even now, when people ask me here on the island what I am, the most common response to my saying, well, I'm Maltese, is, but your name isn't, which begs the question of how many generations one has to live in a place to be considered as being part of it. I used to be able to point to my grandfather's shop on Palace Square, which I'm sure many of you remember, which is, these three facades are now taken up by Marks and Spencers, but you may have remembered my grandfather's shop. And this is another picture courtesy of Richard Ellis, a photographer of Palace Square in a parade in the 1920s, and there you can see my grandfather's shop. It's no longer there. Up to a decade ago, there were many people around who remembered my grandmother standing on the parapet at St. Julian's. Many people also knew my aunt Ondina, who died last year in November. This is Ondina as a young woman in Valletta. Ondina was one of the first women to graduate from the University of Malta, and she was a pharmacist for many years, including during the island's most difficult period in modern history in World War II. The poor often sought her out for medical attention, unable as they often were to pay for a doctor. As to myself, having grown up with a real tangle of origins, and having lived on the island no more than 18 months in all, I don't know if I can make a claim to being Maltese. In removing us to Australia, my father believed that he could avoid the crises of identity that had dogged his and my mother's families. However, living on the other side of the world, we still couldn't avoid being asked who and what we were. My answers used to be evasive to the point that sometimes I felt people thought that I was ashamed of who I was. But the fact is, I didn't quite know who I was. At the same time, when I still find my identity under attack, I feel bound to defend it. Thus, in England, when people say the Australians are uncultured, as they very often do, take my word for it, my hackles rise and I become a real Aussie again. The same thing happens when people criticize the Maltese or attack the Jews. I'm going to just read a couple of pages from my book, which talk about this jumble of identities and my confusion. Although I have lived in many different places, I have been evicted only once for stepping on the tail of a Saluki. Salukis are an exotic breed of dusty colored dogs, which look impossibly more anorexic than whippets and are certainly more jittery. The offender dog was one of four hounds kept by my landlords, an Anglo-German woman and her stateless Hungarian lover. Their house was located in the heart of Tunis's souks, on a cul-de-sac in a maze of lanes, which by the early 1970s had long ceased to be the quarter where female slaves were put up for auction. In the past, it must have been a rich man's house. I had not deliberately stepped on the Saluki's tail. Without my contact lenses, I see only a dandelion fuzz, and since the dog was the same color as the stone slab of my rented room, I only realized it was lying by my bed when it started to howl more pitifully than a professional ululator at a funeral. My landlord accused me of torturing his pet. He gave me no chance to defend myself and ordered me to vacate his property by the end of the week. I wasn't sure where to go to next, but was relieved to be leaving. I had grown weary of the landlord's habit of creeping up on me, his hair brilliantined into two devil's horns designed to make me yelp in fright. More than that, however, I was tired of his peremptory manner, which, before my expulsion, I had taken to be a problem of translating his thoughts from his mother tongue into French, the only language we had in common, or rather his version of French, because he stubbornly refused to learn how to conjugate verbs and only used infinitives. His theory, formulated with lucidity, was that if he accepted the grammatical strictures and ready-made expressions of a language other than his own, he would lose his identity. Beached in Tunisia, without a passport, he had no doubts who or what he was. When asked, he always answered with complete certainty, "I be Hungarian." When faced with this question, his girlfriend and I were much less sure. She had grown up in Britain, but always specified that her parents were from Dresden. I still chirped that I was Australian, yet by this time I was less confident of my label, uncomfortable when prodded to demonstrate allegiance to any group, national or religious. I had just spent a year in Paris, where my precarious Australian identity had come under attack in an unexpected way. Before my arrival, teachers at the school in which I was to give English conversation lessons had been discussing me. Knowing that I was arriving from down under, they laid bets on my having red hair, freckles, broad swimmer's shoulders, and possibly a well-developed tennis arm. I don't know if one of the teachers had staked a lot on these physical traits, but I was astonished when later he introduced me to a stranger as notre petite juive, our little Jewess. A year later, living in the house in Tunis's souks with two people who, like me, were the products of the displacements caused by the confusions of history, I began to see how difficult it is to reduce identity to a single component. When faced with the question of who we are, those of us living in places where neither we nor our parents were born will never be able to give a simple reply. Though I have had a home in England now for 25 years, I cannot get away with saying that I am English. When strangers hear my first name, which is French, and my second, which is Hebrew, and a surname, which is certainly Semitic, I catch the shadow of a frown. It says that, by the look of me, this cannot be true. So I rush in to qualify that although I hold a British passport, I was born in Malta. This needs further clarification, however, for the assumption most people make is that all Maltese are Catholics. I came into this world as one of those great rarities, a Maltese Jew. I suppose it was inevitable, as I grew older, that I would want to untangle all these origins and start to write a book. But when I did start to write, I really hadn't a clue what I was doing. I genuinely couldn't see that the story of a physical journey around the Mediterranean from one branch of my family to another could only hold together if I made it a spiritual journey as well, a quest for identity, not just my own, but that of the members of my family who people my stories. And that realization took me 7 whole years to arrive at. I submitted one draft after another to a not inconsiderable number of publishers, and having received the usual dispiriting pre-printed letters, "Dear author," not even "Dear Miss Tayar," of rejection, decided that I needed the help of a freelance editor in New York, recommended to me by a writer, by the way, who was writing an account of Jewish cowboys in the Wild West, a book that incidentally runs to over 1,600 pages, and which actually has never been published. The book doctor, as they call freelance editors in the US, ended up charging me a great deal of money without actually helping me discover why my manuscript was such a terrible mess. But she did put me onto a writer, Vivian Gornick, who was holding a workshop on autobiography in Santa Fe in New York, and suggested I try and get a place in that workshop to learn something about writing autobiography. Vivian is a wonderful writer, and her account of growing up in a Jewish left-wing family in New York in the 1940s and 50s, entitled Fierce Attachments, is probably one of the most beautifully structured books I've ever read. She is also a tough critic, one in fact who is well known in US creative writing circles as taking no hostages. Having read my manuscript, she wrote me a devastating letter which made me feel that I should, after all, give up trying to tell the story of my family. However, in her letter, she also had a throwaway line which would give me the starting point I was so much in need of. She said that in going through my manuscript, she hadn't a clue as to what all those people in my story were doing, milling about the Mediterranean. So there it was, the key to giving my manuscript a shape, because that's exactly where my spiritual journey would begin, with the goal of discovering what indeed all those people in my family were doing, milling around the Mediterranean. And from there, how my relationship to all those people is indeed the basis of what makes me who I am. Once I was clear that the book would be about a search for identity, I was on my way. And the lessons of the histories of the small Mediterranean communities described in the book gradually became clear to me. The most important lesson being that I could be comfortable with the multiplicity of identities that I was born with. Which is why when nowadays people ask me who I am or what I am, I'm quite happy to reply, I'm Jewish, Maltese, English, Australian, in any order of those words that comes to mind in a particular situation at a particular moment. I was actually going to end the talk here, but I've come back to Malta after an absence of 3 years to clear my late aunt's house, and it's been a very sad week for me, in fact. And I've carried around that feeling of sadness all week. But when I was writing the book, I already had a premonition that I would feel this way once all my ties with the island were broken. And there's one very fragile tie still left, which is my uncle Oscar, who's 95 years old, Mr. Petro Cocchino, who's in our audience, and other people know him well and very kindly visit him from time to time. But this is a very fragile link with the island. So I'd just like to read a final short piece from the book about this sadness that I already felt when I paid a visit to the Jewish cemetery with my aunt Ondina. Malta's Jewish cemetery is located, a wonderful photo of my family waving goodbye. Malta's Jewish cemetery is located far away from the city walls of Valletta, in what has become a sort of traffic island, Perda. With my aunt Ondina, I have come here to see my grandmother's grave. The sun beats down, the air vibrates through the fumes of cars speeding past. The minaret of the Muslim cemetery next door, well tended, thanks to Libyan funding, overlooks the Jewish enclosure. It is the Muslim cemetery's caretaker who has the keys and who opens the gate for us. The appropriateness of this does not escape me. We are a family with a long history in Arab lands. I pick my way among the gravestones that huddle together against the encroaching weeds and struggling bushes. This is not a place people visit often, and it looks forgotten and neglected. One whole corner of the cemetery is taken up by my father's family, by far the largest group among all these dead. The old inscriptions are in Hebrew, the newer ones in English. While Ondina places flowers on her mother's grave, I stand in front of the tomb of a dead Jewish soldier. Wounded in Gallipoli, he had been brought to Malta to recuperate, but it is here that he died. The tall monument was erected by the soldier's parents, resident in Jamaica. The whole of the Jewish people's wanderings are encapsulated in that marmoreal inscription. It speaks to me of people who have traveled far away to the West Indies, with new allegiances to the British Empire, a mother and father have sent a son to fight in a distant country, in a region of the world their ancestors had originally come from. Who, once the last of Rabbi Joseph's and Jacob Israel's descendants have gone, will know our story and remember our connections with the island, I wonder. That web which once spread to all the corner of the Mediterranean and beyond will lose its heart. How then will we define ourselves? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for accepting our invitation. I'd like very much, of course, to thank our two guest speakers who have come from afar to be here with us tonight. I'd like to invite you to a drink and some refreshments outside, and there is the book on sale at the end of the corridor. So have a good evening.